Thanks very much for coming this afternoon. I'm really excited to have an opportunity to talk with you today about work that we've been doing recently, trying to unravel what underlies bacterial growth control. Right, so what I'm going to talk about today is a sort of a top-down approach, a coarse graining of bacterial growth that will result in a very simple mathematical model. And I'll say it right now, it's more than simple. It'll be almost trivial. But what I want to emphasize throughout the talk is not the mathematical techniques, but the mathematical thinking that we bring to the problem. So we're going to develop this very simple mathematical model, and we'll find that although it's not very complicated, it will be quantitatively descriptive of the process. And with just a little bit of work, we can make it quantitatively predictive, and these predictions then will indicate a very tight coupling between bacterial growth control and the central metabolism of the bacterium. And so I'll talk more in detail about the biology as we go. And then finally, at the end, I'd like to conclude by talking about a couple of direct applications of the ideas that I'm talking about today. The first to the design of synthetic genetic circuits, and the second, clinical application in the design of rational antibiotics. All right. And so interrupt me as I go. We're a very small group, so please don't hesitate to interrupt. So I'll start with a brief introduction of what I mean by bacterial growth, what it is, how we measure it. I'll review some bacterial growth laws, which are absolutely astounding features of bacterial physiology. Talk about some recent experiments that we've done to uncover new growth laws, and then finally get into the modeling and the application. All right. So bacteria are among the simplest living organisms, and although I say they're simple, they're by no means trivial. So I'll be talking predominantly about E. coli, which is a bacteria that lives in your gut and ground beef. But one of the nice things about bacteria is that they're tractable living systems, but they're also very, very complicated. Right, so not only do they reproduce themselves, and they reproduce themselves typically very rapidly, but they are also able to survive very adverse conditions and adapt to a number of environmental cues. All right. And so if we look at their life cycle in a very brutal way, you can think of the bacteria as a little machine that takes carbon as an energy source, as a structural molecule, and nitrogen, and makes more of itself. All right, but this isn't an uncontrolled chain reaction. I mean, these just don't happen willy-nilly. The thing that makes bacteria an interesting living organism is that it can adapt to its nutritional conditions. That it can sense the nutritional environment within which it lives, and it can make changes to that program of assimilating carbon and nitrogen in order to make best use of its environment. And so the question that I'll be talking about in broad strokes, philosophically, is what are the global strategies, or what are the policies that the bacteria uses to allocate its various cellular resources in order to achieve the growth rate that it does? All right. So when I talk about growth rate, this is really the first differential equation that we ever see. If we're careful about it, we can get bacteria to grow in a balanced state, but there's nothing limiting its growth. It has all the nutrient it needs, it has all the air it needs, it's at a permissive temperature, in which case it grows exponentially, and almost perfectly exponentially. I'll show you a plot in a second. So we have our number density of cells, growing with some constant and prescribed rate, mu, which is the doubling rate, but I'll alternately talk about doubling time. So 1 over mu is the doubling time. So if I say 3 doublings per hour, it's the same thing as saying it doubles every 20 minutes. So the way that we measure this is we take the bacteria, we put them in some nutrient in a test tube, typically, or flask, put it in a hot water bath, and then shake it up so that it's well aerated. And then we need to measure the number density of cells in the test tube. And that's done by looking at the scattering of light off of these bacteria. So we measure the turbidity of this test tube. And it's the same thing if you had, say, orange juice or apple juice, put it on the shelf, you let it sit, it gets more and more cloudy as the bacteria starts to grow. All right. And then, so this OD600 is meant to, it's called the optical density or the absorbance, And this is a measure of the scattered light, which is proportional to the number density of bacteria in our sample. And if we plot this absorbance on the log linear scale, of course, we should see a straight line if these are growing exponentially. And more than that, the slope will be our doubling rate. So throughout the talk, this is the level of sophistication in terms of experiments that I'll be talking about, more or less. We measure this turbidity at various times, plot it on a log linear scale, draw a line through it, and that's our growth rate. All right. And because we need to draw a line through several points, these are very reproducible measurements. Typically, the errors are less than 2 or 3%. Astoundingly reproducible. But the focus of the talk, of course, is not just a single line, but if we vary the nutritional content of the medium, so here I'm not talking about, say, different concentrations of media. I'm saying we change something like the quality of the carbon source. Right? So it's maybe sugar that the bacterium has more trouble digesting, then it will start to grow slower. Or maybe we put in a nitrogen source that has difficulty metabolizing, again, slower. So we say that for fast growth, the bacteria are growing in rich media, and vice versa for slow growth, poor medium. And again, for E. coli, what makes it such a desirable model organism is that you can get it to grow exponentially under a huge range of conditions. So there, you can get it to grow in virtually any medium, and you can sustain doublings. Probably the record for speed is about 20-minute doublings, but you can go as slow as maybe 5 or 10-hour doublings, all the while growing exponentially. And again, the question then is, once you've given it a particular growth environment, how does it decide on the growth rate? That's the key question that we're talking about. Okay. So when we're talking about establishing growth rate, naturally we start to talk about regulation. And typically when we talk about regulation, it looks something like this, which is very busy. And it's meant to be busy. This is a wiring diagram of all the biochemical interactions that go on inside the regulation of E. coli. And it's tremendously complicated. I mean, it's useful if you know where you are and you know where you want to get to. It's a map, after all. But if we're going to try and describe something globally, like growth rate, it's intractable. We can, of course, develop a mathematical model that reproduce this, but they'll be as complicated as this description that I'm showing you here. So what I want to contrast today is this paradigm with a more top-down approach. All right. And I think that this approach, a sort of bottom-up construction of microscopic interactions giving rise to a gigantic network, is best embodied by Jacques Monod, who pioneered this work in the 50s and 60s. And just to briefly discuss his work, he was looking at a particular strip of DNA that encoded a particular enzyme called LacZ. Well, the enzyme's called beta-galactosidase, and I'll come back to that in a second. And it's an enzyme that allows the cell to digest lactose, which is useful because these are enteric bacteria, and so if you put milk into your stomach, this allows the E. coli to eat the milk. And what he found was that under normal circumstances, there are proteins bound to the DNA that stop this protein from being produced. But that as soon as you put lactose into the system, the lactose knocks off these proteins and stimulates the production of the enzyme that's necessary for its metabolism. So it's a very economic, very clever way to control the expression of proteins in the cell. When you don't need them, they're off. When you need them, they're on. And from Jacques Monod's point of view, this epitomized the way that the cell was controlled. That this was just reproduced all over the place as a paradigm of control in the cell, and that, over the last 50 years, is what gave us the previous slide. Now, I'd like to contrast that with Olimolo, who is alive or working at the same time as Jacques Monod, but now taking a very different view. Oli and his school were looking at coarse-grained observables, like growth rate, like RNA content per cell, protein content per cell. Very much a top-down approach. And that this bottom-up approach has met with great success, I don't need to emphasize, but I want to hopefully convince you that a top-down approach has its merits as well, particularly when we're talking about large-scale phenomena. All right. So any questions so far? This is all background, so All right. So one of the most surprising things that, or definitely one of the early successes of Olemola and his school, was the uncovering of the so-called bacterial growth laws. And what they found was that if they used a variety of different growth media, they were looking at Salmonella, I'll be talking about E. coli, but what they found is that as they varied the growth rate, some things were functions of growth rate alone. So for example, at a particular growth rate, it didn't matter if you changed the carbon source, it didn't matter if you changed the nitrogen source. If it grew at one doubling per hour, it was the same size cell. All right, and why this is important, why this is profound, is what it's saying is that it doesn't matter what regulation that you turn on microscopically, macroscopically, the growth rate's the same. So you might put in a garbage nitrogen source, has to turn up all kinds of enzymes to eat up the nitrogen. Or you might put in a garbage carbon source, it has to turn on all kinds of enzymes to chew up that carbon. But if it's growing at the same rate, then the cell is the same size. But even more than that, they noticed that the RNA per cell is also a function of growth rate alone. It grows slightly faster than the mass per cell or the protein per cell. But nevertheless, whatever is going on microscopically, macroscopically, these are very robust and reliable conclusions. So if I call this the first growth law and this the second growth law, I can express them in a very compact way by saying the ratio of the RNA to the mass or the protein is just a linear function of growth rate alone. And I'll keep coming back to that again and again. And in fact, I'll freeze the slide. All right. So I'll come back to that again and again, that RNA per mass or per protein is a linear function of growth rate, right? Irrespective of how that growth rate is established. Okay. So now let me talk about, first of all, how we understand this linearity. Because this is obviously this is shouting out to be understood. It's a ramrod straight line, and the question is why? What is that telling us? So I'm going to talk about briefly what we mean by growth, and then look at how we might understand that linearity. Okay. So growth in a rough sense means self-replication, but that's not useful from our point of view. We need to develop a mathematical model of what's going on. So we need to go somehow inside the cell. Not so far inside that we're looking at this complicated wiring diagram, but at least on the level that we're describing growth on the coarse grain level. All right. So we want to abstract growth, bacterial growth, as the reproduction of some particular aspect of the cell. And we have two candidates. So let me remind you of how the cell works. It has a strip of DNA called the chromosome that encodes all of the proteins that it uses in its life. And there's a particular group of proteins that bind to the DNA and move along and turn the DNA into RNA in an act called transcription. Then there is another group of predominantly RNA and a little bit of protein called the ribosomes that bind to this, move along, and make proteins in an act called translation. But notice that each of these are made up of proteins. And so each of these are a candidate for an autofeedback loop. We have these polymerases making more proteins to make more polymerases. There's a feedback loop. We have these ribosomes making more proteins to make more ribosomes. And there are a lot of reasons. I'll just show you briefly one reason. But there are a lot of reasons to focus on ribosomes. Probably the most compelling is that at fast growth, the cell is almost all made up of ribosomes. So this is the protein synthesizing machinery of the cell. And if we're growing at 20-minute doublings, the cell needs to make 72,000 ribosomes every 20 minutes. This is a huge burden. To a first approximation, then, what we're going to think of is that the cell is just a loose bag of ribosomes making ribosomes. Everything else is just ancillary. All right? And the question is, if we think of it that way, how far will it take us? Okay, will that bring us any closer to understanding why this RNA to protein ratio is a linear function of growth rate? Okay, so this is what I mean by bringing to bear a mathematical way of thinking, although the mathematics won't be that complicated. Okay. Okay, so one tiny technicality. I won't be talking, from a modeling point of view, it's more straightforward if I don't try to compare two disparate things like RNA and protein. It turns out that RNA is really a measure of the number of ribosomes in the cell. Most of the RNA is ribosomal RNA, and so you can think of this as number of ribosomes per protein is a linear function of growth rate. But to be a little bit more careful, there's a direct proportionality between the RNA in the cell and the ribosomal protein in the cell, and so I'm going to re-express this linearity as saying the fraction of ribosomal protein to total protein is a linear function of growth rate. All right. So that's what I'm beginning from. And now I'm going to talk about the mathematical modeling aspect. Okay. So on the coarsest possible level, you can think of bacterial growth as ribosomes making ribosomes and making other proteins. But that's their job and that's how they function. And they do that by incorporating what are called amino acids, polymerizing them together, turning them into proteins. And they do this at some given rate, gamma, which I'm going to call the elongation rate. Okay, so now there's some fraction of ribosomes making ribosomes, and there's some residual fraction making other proteins. And that's it. That's as complicated as the model is going to get. Well, it'll become slightly more complicated, but by and large, it's as complicated as it gets. And so if we look at an ordinary differential equation description of this, the rate at which these ribosomes increase is some fraction of ribosomes making ribosomes times some rate at which they work, and then the other proteins increase some fraction of ribosomes making other proteins times some intrinsic rate at which they work. All right. Now, as I said, everything that I'm going to be talking about is going to be in balanced exponential growth. These cells are going to be growing exponentially. And in that case, we also know that the rate at which they increase is equal to their growth rate, by definition. So we can replace this left-hand side, obviously, by these growth rate terms. And so now we're left with, instead of a set of ordinary differential equations, algebraic equations, and immediately two facts pop out, or two results pop out. The first is that we can cancel R from both sides, and we have an expression for the growth rate, which we can measure, in terms of this elongation rate, this translation rate, which we can also measure. Right? These are two experimentally verifiable quantities, and this proportionality constant, this fraction of ribosomes making ribosomes, is in a sense indirect. We can't measure this. But a second relation pops out of these. If I add the two equations together and then divide the first by their sum, I end up with the fraction of ribosomal protein to total protein is precisely that proportionality constant. So if you believe the model, then what we have is three quantities that we can measure simultaneously related to one another, and more than that, we have a linear dependence of the ribosomes, the fraction of ribosomal protein to total protein as a function of growth rate, and the slope of that line is 1 over this elongation rate. Right, so this is suggesting that very brutally looking at ribosome partitioning, we get insight into this empirical relationship, these bacterial growth laws. All right, is everyone with me here? Okay, so as I say, we can measure this, we can measure this. In principle, we can measure this too, and so they should all agree with one another. And as I said at the beginning, the way that we change growth rate usually is we put either some poor carbon source or some poor nitrogen source or some rich carbon source, rich nitrogen source to vary the growth rate of these cells. There we go. And so these are experiments that we did with E. coli. Glucose is a good carbon source, glycerol is poor. Good nitrogen source, bad nitrogen source is going down. And now if we plot the ribosome, fraction of ribosomal protein to total protein, you see that it is a very straight line. All right? And more than that, we can measure the slope, and if you measure the slope, it's about 20 amino acids per second as the elongation rate, which is verifiable from independent measures. So it looks like everything is consistent. And so this suggests that this ribosome partitioning model can explain, in some sense, this growth law that Schachter and Moll have discovered. All right. And what it also suggests is that the translation rate is constant and maximal over all the growth rates that we look at. So obviously, one question then is why? Why would you keep the translation rate constant and maximal? But of course, you can't answer that. It's a philosophical question. More empirically, we can ask, what happens if we start to play with this translation rate? All right. So this is all background. Now I'm going to talk about new experiments that we've been doing to do exactly that, to fiddle with these growth laws and ask what happens. And whether the model that I talked about, this partitioning of ribosomes, is rich enough to describe the behavior. And if it is, what can we learn from that? Is that clear to everyone? All right. So there are a number of ways, maybe I'll now freeze this slide. There are a number of ways that we can perturb the elongation rate, this translation rate. So there are several antibiotics whose chief mode of action is to bind with the ribosome and stop it from working. Right? For example, chlorpheniclone. What they do is they, just, as I say, they bind to the ribosome and then it can't take up any amino acids anymore. And if you add enough of that, of course, it's going to kill the bacteria. But if you add just a little bit, it will stay alive and grow exponentially, but at a slower rate. And so the question is, these are the points that I showed before with no chlorpheniclone. These are growing naturally, no antibiotic. What would happen if I started adding antibiotic to this? Does anyone want to guess? Probably not. So say you added, you took this guy and you added antibiotic. It'll go slower. So it'll move this way. Right? Now the question is, will it go down or up? What do you say, up? Did you say up? Yeah, all right. It's kind of, it looks like it might go up because I left a lot of space there. But you can think of it like this. It's going to stop. Let me show you. It does go up. And that, I think, is what you would expect it to go to the left because, of course, the growth rate goes down when you start to poison the cells. It goes up, I think, because the cell isn't taking up amino acids anymore. It's blocked from taking up these amino acids. And so it looks around and it says, I have so many amino acids around. I must be in a very rich environment. So it starts to make more ribosomes. These ribosomes don't work very well, but the cell doesn't know that. So it upregulates this ribosome production. That's maybe one way to understand this. However you understand it, it's empirically what we see is this increase. Now the question here, there are two interesting things here. One is that it goes up almost linearly. And if we start doing the same with the rest of these, they all also go up almost linearly. And more than that, they converge to the same point. All right? And so we see more or less a linear fit through all of these. Very different media, doesn't matter. Put in chlorpheniclone, they start to grow slower. Their ribosomes start to be upregulated, but they all go to this common Y-intercept. And so we can empirically describe this by a straight line with a common Y-intercept. The growth rate is my horizontal variable. And this lambda is just meant to be the slope at all points along this line. And you can think of lambda as a measure of the quality of the nutrient. The better the nutrient is, the higher you are up on this line, the higher lambda is. Okay. And I should mention that this isn't just an artifact of using chlorpheniclone. We can use different antibiotics. We can use tetracycline. We can use fecitic acid. All of these interrupt translation, and all of these give similar behavior. We can even go in and start fiddling with the DNA. Still, we get this linear rise as we start to fiddle with translation. So this is suggesting that what we're seeing here is a new growth law, a universal behavior in the face of decreasing elongation rate. Okay, so we started to fiddle with this slope, and what you see is not just the line going up like this, but you see these points converging to a common intercept. And again, this linearity and this reproducibility is suggesting to us that there must be something underlying this. And the question is what? How do we understand it? All right. So to understand it, we need to extend the model somewhat. And we're led to do that by the work of Pedersen and co-workers. And so what they did is they looked at a whole gamut of proteins at different growth rates. And they measured these at different growth rates, and they noticed that some of them increased, their levels increased as growth rate increased. Some of them, their levels decreased as growth rate increased, and some stayed the same. And so I can say this in, or I can illustrate this in pie chart form by saying that maybe at some low rate, they're partitioned equally, but as the growth rate increases, of course, these upregulated proteins increase at the expense of these downregulated proteins. All right. So now what we'll do is we'll say, well, we know that one of the, or some of the components of this upregulated fraction are the ribosomal proteins. That's what we've been talking about the whole time. As growth rate increases, the ribosomal protein content increases. So we'll describe this upregulated fraction as being some growth rate independent multiple of the ribosomal proteins. And that will allow us then to extend our original model very slightly. And so now we have three classes. Before we had ribosomes making ribosomes and ribosomes making other proteins. Now we have ribosomes making ribosomes and sundry other proteins that are co-regulated with them, and ribosomes making proteins that are downregulated, and ribosomes making some core that's constant with growth rate. Right. Slightly more elaborate, but not all that much. And this is really as complicated as it's going to get. So again, we can describe this with differential equations, and again, the differential equations follow directly from the illustration. This time, though, for the downregulated proteins, we say that whatever is left over is what's going to be translating them. They're the last in the pecking order. And that's why we see them downregulated with growth rate. All right. And this constant core, I'm not going to worry about because it doesn't change with growth rate. It's just some sort of sink, some extra leftover. All right. Okay, is that clear to everyone? Any of that? All right. So now we can ask, if that's our model, then what can we say about this downregulated fraction B? So we know what's going on here as we add clonfenicol, what's going on here. And again, because these are growing exponentially, we can do some simple algebra, and we end up with an expression of these D proteins as a fraction of total protein, analogous to this R proteins as a fraction of total proteins. Okay. And now so I'm going to come back to this in the next slide, but very briefly I'm going to run through some algebra very quickly. So if I put in this empirical relationship into that relationship, I get a proportionality between these two fractions, which in and of itself at this point is not interesting, but again, I'll come back to it. But then if I take this and plug it into these governing equations, I get an explicit expression for the growth rate. And what's interesting here, just in terms of consistency, is that for a given medium, this model parameter is fixed. This is just telling us abstractly the quality of the medium. This common intercept, of course, is fixed. It's a universal constant. And so that's saying that the growth rate, if you believe this, the growth rate is maximal if you make this elongation rate maximal. So it's suggesting that there's some consistency to what we're saying. That part of keeping this growth rate, or this elongation rate, maxed out and constant over all growth rates is that it maximizes the growth rate at that particular stage. And as I say, I'll come back to this proportionality later and ask what does it imply in terms of a connection between ribosome partitioning, so this protein synthesizing machinery, and central metabolism. All right. But what I want to talk about first is what are the kinds of proteins that we find here? So we find ribosomal proteins here. What are the kind of proteins that we find here? Now we have this expression for their fraction, and we have an expression for this fraction of ribosomal protein, the total protein, either as we change nutrient or we add antibiotics. So by substitution then, we can arrive at expressions for what this protein fraction does in either case. Either we're changing the nutrients or we're adding antibiotics. And so if we can find proteins that display this kind of characteristic, then that would be suggestive that they're part of this defraction. First of all, it would give us confidence that there is actually some fraction, that this model makes sense. And second of all, we can identify proteins that are in there. So if it were possible, we would look at all of the proteins in E. coli as a function of growth rate and ask whether their expression levels go up or go down. Of course, that's not practical. So what we're going to say is that if we can find any particular protein that exhibits this characteristic, it will be in that fraction. And that will give us some sense of what might be lurking in that subcategory. All right. So the logic is, let's try and find something that looks like this as we change nutrient, and hopefully that will tell us what's going on a deeper level. But as I say, if we're going to just look at a particular enzyme, I'm going to have to give up knowing what the slope is here because I need to rescale the vertical. So I'm going to say, all right, I'm just going to look for something that falls linearly with growth rate and has a particular intercept that I'll talk about in a second. And I actually can't say anything about the slope because I don't know what fraction of this total fraction is my enzyme. All right. Well, it turns out that there are a lot of proteins that exhibit this kind of characteristic. Okay, and the first set that I'm going to talk about are not all that interesting in and of themselves, but what they tell us about metabolism is interesting, and so I'll get to that in a second. But if we look at, for example, old work by Williamson and her coworker on what are called constitutive proteins, and these are proteins that are unregulated. These are proteins that, on the face of it, are not under any kind of control. Okay, so these fall out of the purview of Jacques Monod and that wiring diagram I showed you earlier. But if you look at their expression, and so she has a particular bacteria that produces these three proteins without any regulation. They are produced by this bacterium. But if you measure the level of these proteins as a function of growth rate, you see something remarkable. So I'm going to scale them all so that because they're different proteins, they have different ways of measuring them. But remember, I don't care what the scale of the vertical axis is. I only care whether it's linear and whether it has an intercept of a particular form, which I'll show you in a second. So I scale them so that at a growth rate of one doubling per hour, they have an activity or a presence of one. All right, and then I plot her results. And you can see that for very different enzymes, they all have a very similar linear fall with growth rate. But more than that is this intercept, which is very suggestive, and I'll tell you why. If we then plot the data that I showed you earlier where we started adding antibiotic, we end up with all of these coming to a common limit. Now, if we read across, we should have an intercept of about 3.5 doublings per hour, which is the maximum possible growth rate if all of our ribosomes were making ribosomes at some given rate. And indeed, we see a commonality between these two plots. And these plots are measuring very different things. Very different things over huge spans of time. So we're talking about data collected 30 years ago studying particular proteins, data collected last summer looking at RNA and E. coli. And so the commonality of these intercepts, I think, is very suggestive. But more than that, we can look at different strains of E. coli. So this is now a different strain used in the 50s and 60s. And again, if you start to inhibit translation through a variety of ways, either antibiotic or through mutations, you again see this common colocalization. And again, you see this intercept around 3.6, 3.7, 16, 17-minute doublings. And again, we can look in this strain at an expression of a protein that has no regulation at all. And we see that it falls and has the same intercept. So this is saying that the model that I've talked about is able to synthesize a lot of disparate data into a coherent picture. And that coherent picture is that we have a hierarchy of synthesis in the cell. We have the cell making more protein synthesizing machinery, and then whatever's left over goes to making unregulated proteins. And then, of course, there's this core that keeps it alive. Okay, any questions about that? So one candidate for this down-regulated fraction, this D fraction that falls with growth rate, is simply proteins with no control. Uncontrolled proteins. All right. So I said before we had this empirical relationship that was, if you pass it through the model, equivalent to this other relationship relating the fraction of down-regulated proteins to ribosomal proteins. And the question is, what does this imply? And what I mean specifically is, what does this say about controlled proteins? So remember, these are proteins where we've broken out the regulation, what can it tell us about proteins that have the regulation built in? And I think that the answer is perhaps obvious when we say it. I'll come to it in a second, but let's look in more detail at what goes on when we're growing. So as I say, we have these ribosomes making ribosomes and other things, and they're incorporating amino acids at some fixed rate. So imagine for the moment that the growth is limited by the availability of a particular amino acid. Okay. So I want to know what is this linearity telling us? What's a possible where could this have come from? All right. So our growth is limited by some amino acid, and we assume that this amino acid is made either biosynthetically or it's transported in by some enzyme E. All right. And then we can look at the flux of this amino acid, the flux out and the flux in. And at balanced growth, at exponential growth, these two should be the same. And the consumption is simple. I mean, these are consumed by translation, so it's the number of ribosomes translating and the rate at which they translate. That's fine. Now the supply, I'm not interested in the details, but we assume that it's linear with this enzyme. The more enzyme you have, the faster you make that amino acid. And these are just some constants that I'm not very interested in. Now, if I make the assumption that this enzyme is itself part of this downregulated fraction, then in balanced growth, all of these are constant, and I get exactly what I found. Right? That I have a linear relationship between the fraction of ribosomes making ribosomes and the fraction of ribosomes making these B proteins. So what is that saying? What that's saying is that it's sufficient in order to get this behavior that our growth-limiting enzyme is uncontrolled, in a sense, unregulated. All right? And many genes in catabolism and metabolism that are responsible for just this are positively regulated, so when you turn them on, they're turned on. Right? What that means is that if you turn them on, they're basically unregulated. Do you see what I'm saying? So we have these enzymes, these proteins that have no control at all, and they behave, as we saw, straight line falling down. What I'm suggesting is that important enzymes that are responsible for metabolizing the nutrients in the environment, once they're turned on, we can control them passively. And so, for example, this is not a mutated strain of E. coli now. This is a wild-type strain. Looking at that very enzyme that Jacques Monod was looking at when he developed all his ideas of regulation, this beta-galactosidase, which is responsible for the metabolism of lactose. And we see that very suggestive fall with growth rate. So that's the idea. That's a suggestion. So that once you turn it on, once you tell it has lactose in the environment, you don't need to fine tune it. At high growth rates, what's that?
It will find this value.
Exactly. And I think that a sort of a philosophical way to think of it is that at high growth rates, the nutrient is very, I mean, the environment is very nutritious. It doesn't need a lot of enzyme to break things down. So it naturally would want them to be pretty low expressed. Where it's growing very slowly, it needs a lot of work to get any nutrient out of the environment. So it's up. Right, exactly. There's two. Oh, I see. So what is the connection that connects ribosomes to these proteins?
Could be some kind of feedback.
Exactly. And I won't talk about that here, but the idea is that if you can control ribosomes, you control everything else. And so the feedback need not be directed toward all the proteins in the cell. You just need to direct it to the ribosomes. As long as the ribosomes can sense whether there's a lot of nutrient or not enough nutrient, that's enough. Everything else is passively regulated. That's the suggestion. But I can talk about the details if you're interested, because biochemically we know that that's also true. All right. And so this is with full induction. So this is turning the gene fully on. But these two, so this guy looks like lactose to the cell, and that's why it turns fully on. But there's a secondary molecule that in the presence of, I didn't say this earlier, but in the presence of glucose, it turns off this protein, because glucose is a much better carbon source. But we add add this particular chemical to the growth environment, and that fully turns on the protein. But if you don't add that, then if there's glucose in the growth medium, it shuts off the cell's endogenous supply of that compound, and you see slightly less expression of that protein. But now, this doesn't look anything like this. Except if we take away the glucose points, it doesn't look all that different. All right? And so the question is, when people are thinking about global methods of regulation, so for example, feedback loops that control particular enzymes or particular classes of enzymes, how much of what they observe is due to this passive control that I'm talking about today? Or if you like, not passive control, but global control. All right? And so that's what we're looking at currently. Is that clear to everyone? So if it's on, it's basically unregulated is the point there. All right.
Is it accidental that you're 2 inches of the thing?
Oh, this dashed line is exactly that solid line. I just put it up for comparison. And the point is, it's not a very good fit over here. But on the other hand, it's not terrible. Here, I think it's quite a good fit. So here we would expect it not to be behaving this way. But it does behave sort of that way. And the question is, how much is due to this passive control and how much is bona fide biochemical feedback? All right. So to conclude, I'm going to talk about two applications to of these ideas that are also being explored. One is to the construction of synthetic genetic circuits. So this is where we artificially make strips of DNA and insert them into the bacterium and ask the bacterium to deal with this DNA. And typically we encode very clever structures so that we can see very clever things happening. So I'll tell you more about that as we go. And the second application is to understanding how bacteria develop antibiotic resistances. All right. So imagine a particular strip of DNA that encodes a protein that stimulates its own production. So this is a positive feedback loop, sometimes called an autoactivator. And you can see that just like any autoactivator, any positive feedback, it will have two states. So it's like a microphone and a speaker. You point the microphone at the speaker, it's got a low state if everybody's quiet, but then you just make a little bit of noise, it goes into its high feedback, high state. The same thing with this genetic circuit. No expression of the protein, but then once you have a little bit, it starts to synthesize its own production and it saturates in a high state. So if we look at a simplified model of this circuit, we can plot the control parameters and look at regions of bistability and ask, is it a good idea to make the circuit? Will I see bistable behavior? And so here I've drawn this Ka just describes how the binding affinity of the protein, so how sensitive the feedback is, and this is the strength of the feedback, how much the protein activates its own synthesis. All right, and then we can plot for a given growth rate regions of bistability, and we say, oh, there's a huge region here. It's well worth building the circuit. But there's something important to notice here. For bacteria, protein is not degraded actively, or very rarely is it degraded actively. It's usually diluted out by growth. You stop making it, the cell divides a few times, and eventually you've diluted the protein away. So the faster you're growing, the more dilute the protein is. Which means that as you change the growth rate, you're going to be changing this A-naught is the maximal amount of protein in the cell. You'll be changing that. And so you'll change this region of bistability. And so if you wanted this circuit to work for all growth rates, you're out of luck. unless you put in some sort of control that will account for that. All right, so what we say is that then the robustness of this genetic circuit to growth rate change is very sensitive to growth rate change. So it's not robust. The robustness is a growth rate dependent quantity. All right. The second thing that I want to talk about is I've been talking about chloramphenicol throughout. An interesting thing about chloramphenicol is that it's a natural antibiotic. It's produced by Streptococcus, and it's used to kill other bacteria around it. But obviously, because Streptococcus is itself a bacteria, it needs to encode some sort of bacterial resistance. And the chief mode of resistance that Streptococcus and other bacteria adopt is the expression of a particular enzyme called CAT, which is called chloramphenicol acetyltransferase. And it takes these OH groups and turns them into acetyl groups, which are big, bulky groups, which makes it so that the chloramphenicol can't bind to the ribosome, can't do its job. Right, that's how bacteria gain resistance to this particular antibiotic. But now notice a curious feature here. If we're talking about a particular cell with these particular ribosomes being acted on by chloramphenicol, it needs to produce this enzyme to deactivate the chloramphenicol. Okay, so this is all going on in the same cell. So that means these ribosomes are making that enzyme. Now what I want to emphasize here is that the logic is positive, negative, negative. So you have a double negative, which means you have a positive feedback loop again. The logic is exactly the same as what we talked about here. And so there's a possibility that this process is bistable. So you have a sensitive bacterial population where this CAT enzyme is not present or not being made, and it's susceptible to the antibiotic. But as soon as it develops any kind of resistance at all, it flips to the high state, which is high growth. It dominates the culture and it becomes totally resistant. And so the question is, if we look at different antibiotics that maybe don't target ribosomes, maybe don't move the cells along this direction when we add them, but rather maybe move them in this direction, can we avoid this bistability? Is that a more rational approach to the design of antibiotics? All right. And so most of this work was done, all of this work actually was done, University of California in San Diego. And Carl Gunderson has taken over the project since I left. And this was all done in the lab of Terry Waugh. The last two applications that I talked about, Stefan Klump was looking at this robustness of genetic circuits, and Barrett Darris is looking at this bistability in antibiotic design. And so thank you all for coming this afternoon. I'm really pleased that you were able to come.